Hey, everybody, this is Joe Turner with the City Manager Unfiltered podcast. Up next, I have an interview with Troy Boddy. He's the Hopkinsville, Kentucky City Manager. He's just an absolutely fascinating individual, truly an international man of mystery, and he has one of the most unique backgrounds you're ever going to find in a city manager. I'm really excited to share this interview with you. I did this interview a few weeks back. I've been marinating on it, and honestly, upon reflection, I truly believe Troy probably has the most difficult city manager assignment in the country. I want you to take a listen to this episode and let me know if you disagree. But he has some unique challenges, and I think you will at least agree to that. Before we hop into the episode, I got a couple more announcements I want to make. Next week, I'm going to drop an interview with CJ Grisham. You might recall that name. He is the pistol packing attorney that I talked about in a previous episode a few weeks ago, probably back in January. He got kicked out of the Aransas Pass City Council meeting during the public comment period. He was threatened with arrest because he dropped about a dozen F-bombs plus the C-bomb. He was representing his client who also got threatened with arrest and was booted from the meeting right before he went up to go speak for dropping some curse words and what have you. Anyway, me and CJ Grisham, we had a long chat about the First Amendment, public comment period, what you can and can't say. I think you're going to find that interview to be really interesting and entertaining. So stay tuned for that. That's going to come out next week. On top of that, I want to update you on the newsletter. I put out a newsletter about 7 weeks or so ago. It's already up to 6,000 subscribers. In that newsletter, I put in a list of each week's city and county managers who have either resigned, been terminated, or retired. I also have some stray ACM-DCM movement as well. So if you're interested in knowing what's going on in the profession, what jobs are coming open, you're going to want to subscribe to that newsletter. I'm also including job listings for senior and executive level recruitments. So if you have a city manager recruitment you're doing in-house for, if you have an assistant ACM-DCM, if you have a department head, assistant department head, and you want to include them in the newsletter, it's only $100. There's more information about it in the show notes. It's a really great value because you guys know I have the largest and most targeted audience when it comes to city managers and other public sector executives. It was a busy week last week. I launched a new website called citymanagernews.com. I can't post all the articles I come across on LinkedIn. There's just not enough room, not enough time. What I'm going to do is I'm going to start doing a daily roundup. I think I'm going to do a daily roundup of all the articles that I come across and share them with you guys. So if you want to stay current on city manager, county manager related news, I'll throw in a little bit of local government news here that I think is kind of relevant or interesting. But if you are interested in staying abreast of what's going on in the city and county management profession, you're going to want to check out citymanagernews.com. on the daily. And don't forget, May 1st is coming up. I have that big announcement Micah Gaudet and I are going to share with you. We have something big that we're planning to announce to the public, and we want you to be a part of it. So stay tuned for more information about May 1st, the May 1st announcement that we are going to be bringing out. I think you're really going to want to tune in and find out what we're working on. So let's jump into the episode now with Troy Boddy. He is the Hopkinsville, Kentucky City Manager, and he has the toughest city manager job in the country. All right, all right, all right. I'm Joe Turner, and this is the City Manager Unfiltered Podcast, a podcast for city managers and other public sector executives. It is the most influential local government podcast in America, and I've been looking forward to this interview for quite some time. I'm just very eager to have this conversation with my buddy Troy Boddy. Troy and I, we go back to the very beginning, honestly. I started posting late August, early September of 2022. And me and Troy were actually having some conversations about me driving out and visiting him on a Thanksgiving holiday when I was going to drive my kid out to South Carolina because he's going to the Navy. Unfortunately, our schedules couldn't work on that busy holiday weekend, but we go way back. And Troy, you first caught my attention on LinkedIn because you have some pretty edgy comments that are not typical of your city managers out there who like to keep a low profile. And obviously, I'm a pretty edgy person myself. So when you started engaging with my content very early on, we connected. I'm just really happy to have you on the program. Why don't you introduce yourself to the audience so they can get a little flavor for your background?
Thank you first for having me on. I'm Troy Boddy. A lot of people call me Boddy. I'm the city administrator here in Hopkinsville over in Western Kentucky. We're about 50, 55 miles north of Nashville, Tennessee. And I've been in this position come May 14th, 6 years. My background is varied. If you took a look at my resume prior to here, I was actually working overseas in international development and came back to the country in late, I believe, 2016. And I eventually made my way over here. But I have worked in local government, state government, and international affairs.
Yeah, you have one of the most diverse, non-traditional city manager backgrounds probably in the country. I would think that's fair to say. And I think you probably have one of the more difficult assignments in the country when it comes to being a city manager or city administrator. We're going to unpack that in a minute. But if I understand your resume correctly, and I was reading it right, you were living overseas in South Sudan, maybe even South Africa, Zimbabwe. I mean, you were all over the place, I think. I'm not sure if you can unpack that a little bit, but.
And the companies I work for moved me around, and you understand that going in, you go where the work is, wherever they send you. And when I arrived, it was the Sudan, the largest country in Africa, but they were wanting to split. And that was our part in, you know, we weren't driving them to separate from the northern part of the country. We were going to help them in their separation, set up their government properly, and hopefully a democratic state and promoting democracy. So that was our role. They separated back in 2011. South Sudan now is the newest country still in the world. I would argue the poorest and very troubled. And a lot of the news you're hearing in the country about, you're hearing a lot of news in international media about Sudan, the northern part of that state.
Okay.
Not hearing enough, unfortunately, about South Sudan, but there's very troubled space. But new countries start out trouble, and we hope they work their way through it and hopefully someday become a prosperous state.
Well, you know, you look at your resume, and you spent some time working for a governor of Kentucky.
Great man.
You worked in high levels in West Virginia, correct?
My second home.
West Virginia is your second home?
I call it that. I went to West Virginia for graduate school, and there are just some places that just take you in, man, and they open opportunities for you. And I can't say enough good things about that beautiful state. In graduate school, I did a master's degree in political science, urban, state, and local government, mostly cities. And I had an intern at the state legislature, like a full-time job, 8 hours a day, driving an hour to get there, interning all day for the Senate Education Committee, driving back and doing my classes in the evening at Marshall University. It was a busy time. And the state just really, really embraced me.
So walk me through this transition to Hopkinsville in Kentucky, because you had these high level state and sort of, I don't want to say federal, but they're these international assignments where you're doing some pretty heady stuff. So you're doing these high level state level assignments, and then you're also doing these international assignments. What made you decide to come back to the states and then get involved at the local level as a city manager, city administrator role?
New Orleans. I worked in New Orleans after, I like to say after I left the governor's office in Kentucky, but those of us that worked in that administration, the state of Kentucky left us. We didn't win re-election, but I had some friends, actually go back to West Virginia. I had a friend, she lived in West Virginia, but she was born in New Orleans, and she had a house in both places, and she works for an architect and planning company down there. And the city had been hit by a storm. And she was pushing me on city officials to come and help them pull down the federal monies to get the city rebuilt. And it was in New Orleans, really working on the local level, but I was paid by the feds there, that would become one of the toughest, if not the toughest job I've ever had. And it was very stressful, as you can imagine, one of the worst natural disasters that have been recorded. And working with a team of staff that were not only trying to rebuild their city, but then when they got off work, they had to go try to rebuild their homes, rebuild their mothers, rebuild their churches. And it was a very stressful time, but it was one of the best times of my life. You would get stopped in the supermarket. I'm laughing because there's a particular supermarket uptown, and I saw someone coming down an aisle, try to skip over to another aisle, and she ran around and she got me. She said, New Orleans, that Creole way of speaking, most of America, we say we're going grocery shopping. Down there, they say we're making groceries. And don't try to make sense of that.
I've never heard that before, making groceries.
Making groceries. And she caught me, and she goes, where is this? What is that? They held me accountable. They knew who I was, and they held me accountable. I remember being in a theater uptown, a one-screen theater, being tapped on the shoulder. You said you were going to get that street fixed, and you turn it around going, whoa. They held me accountable. They wanted their city rebuilt, and I was on the team to help rebuild it, and I liked the accountability. I really did. It was very emotional, but you had to understand that emotion.
Yeah.
People were finding bodies and people were being, I mean, that's where you truly felt hopelessness. And I hate to admit it, but there were a couple of times I felt hopeless. that, you know, you'd stop and think, are we going to get this done?
Right.
But we did. And you do it day by day, piece by piece. And I tell you, I was there when we won the Super Bowl. And I cannot, Joe, tell you what that meant for that city at that time. If any town needed a Super Bowl win, it was the Saints and New Orleans.
Wow.
And
yeah.
That's my favorite football team forever.
Is that how you fell in love with local government then, that ability to make a direct impact and that connection there?
Yeah. You start right then. In Frankfort is the capital of Kentucky. In the governor's office, people drove from everywhere to come to work every morning, hours and so forth. And you worked on things, but you didn't always see them immediately. In local government, and this is the case all across America, people know if we're delivering or not. And when you're talking about rebuilding, we had to provide services and rebuild at the same time. And it was strenuous. And that is why if you follow me on LinkedIn, you see I'm a huge proponent of code enforcement and public works. Of course, we're all proponents of fire and police, and we should be. But I'll say even in this community here in Hopkinsville, they are always bringing things to the police department, bringing things to the fire department. They've been amazing supporting our teams. And we push, you know, public works is there too. They're there at 3 a.m. brining and salting those roads. They're that unseen group of people out there making your city work. And code enforcement, really code enforcement rebuilt New Orleans. And that's where I was working. I wasn't supposed to. Next thing I know, they're bringing code under me. It caught me off guard, but I'm working with the code team. And I really give them so much credit in rebuilding that city. And I saw the value and the importance of code enforcement and the role it plays in the municipality.
That's one of the things I've always enjoyed about your writings on LinkedIn is I know you're a big supporter of code enforcement. I'm a big supporter of code enforcement for a variety of reasons. I think it's just one of the best ways to keep your city looking good, aesthetically, values up. I think it solves a lot of problems or indirectly solves a lot of problems if you have the forethought and you're attacking these issues early on. I think it helps prevent individuals or problems from certain businesses to get transferred over and put on the shoulders of the rest of the taxpayers, right? The transference of that burden and that pain. And I'm not a fan of that. So I know you've always been strong on that. I'm curious. So when you go to Hopkinsville, did you say, hey, I want to be a city manager. I want to be a city administrator and start applying? Or did this job just sort of fall into your lap?
There were actually about three jobs opened in Western Kentucky at that time. Paducah, Kentucky, beautiful little town, farther west, closer to Missouri, about an hour from here. A little smaller, very historic, very artsy town. Hopkinsville and Bowling Green at that time, about 80,000 people over there at Western Kentucky University, where they manufacture Corvettes in the Corvette Museum. Bowling Green kind of knew. They've got Jeff Measle, a friend of mine. He was their chief financial officer, and they sort of transitioned him into that place. So I had applied at Paducah, and I applied at Hopkinsville, but the mayor of Hopkinsville at that time, named Carter Hendricks, saw something in my resume that I can only speak candidly. I don't lie very well. It's a hard sell with international affairs on your resume to bring it back to Kentucky.
It is.
Very hard sell.
I could see that for sure.
And I was in Louisville, the largest city. It's a hard sell. Now, having international affairs, if you're in New York or Seattle or Chicago or something, that comes with, especially D.C., that comes with the territory. But in Kentucky, it's a hard sell. Even though I was managing federal dollars from the U.S. government, following the same rules and regulations, I was just in a war zone. And Carter, at that time, he said to me that he thought my international experience and other work would be an asset. Would add value and bring a bit of a different flavor to city administration here.
That's awesome. You know, you talk about that, and I look at your resume because I did some prep for this assignment. And you know, Troy, I'm gonna ask you a candid question. I mean, I look at your resume and I see your diverse background. I see your successes that you had in Kentucky. You have a remarkable record in Kentucky. When's the last time you had a recruiter contact you and invite you to apply for a position? Does that happen? Because they should be beating your door down.
I get emails, and I think all of you do.
Yeah, but those are the generic emails. Have you had anybody actually reaching out and say, hey, Troy, we got a job we want you to apply for or check out?
Yeah, and I'm going to choke you when I see you. But yeah, and so you know what? To be very candid, my team does. I won't say her name, but our CFO at our retreat with City Council was talking about that once she just recently finished her CPA and got her master's and all that. And people reach out to her. There's a talent shortage out there, as you know.
Absolutely.
And I learned what you've done remarkably is you filled a niche. I mean, you brought city managers together in a way, and some of that, you know, in the South, particularly in the Black community, if you grew up in church, the older women would always say, before they got ready to say something they probably shouldn't say, they'd say, quiet as it's kept. And I think Toni Morrison in one of her novels wrote, quiet as it's kept. And there was so much, I think, quiet as it's kept, city managers didn't get a chance or opportunity to say to each other and say candidly. And a lot of us were going through struggles that we didn't invent, you know, they're happening, but we just had no connection. Then here come you trying to break down walls and, you know, what you do and connected us in a different kind of way. Yeah, there are things that, you know, we're being reached out to. Of course, there's a shortage. I'm amazed at the shortage. Reading your blog and now Googling certain things on my own, I read in one city, and it may have come from you, where I believe they hired a reporter that covered city council to be their city administrator, city manager. That just shocked me.
There's a lot of non-traditional candidates entering the field because there's a lack of supply, right? There's a lot of demand, lack of supply. And, you know, to me, if I was a recruiter, which I'm not, obviously, but if I was a public sector recruiter, Troy Boddy would be on my automatic call list whenever I have a pretty good vacancy that I'm looking to fill with some talent. So let's talk about Hopkinsville a little bit more. Okay. So you have, in my opinion, one of the more, I'm not going to say the most difficult assignment in the country, because there's a lot of difficult assignments and there's a lot of communities and whatnot, but you have to be up in the top tier of 1-2% difficult challenges, because just by virtue of the structure of your government. So for those who are listening at home who aren't aware, Troy Boddy has the unenviable task of reporting to a governing body that consists of 12 council members and a mayor. And get this, every council member is up for re-election every 2 years, not staggered, not 4-year terms, every 2 years. So in every 2 years, Troy has to run the risk of having a massive turnover within his governing body and rebuilding, restarting not only these relationships that you have with these individuals that you work with that obviously control your future and your livelihood, but also educating them and coaching them up on the way the government works so you can actually process and run your organization. Can you speak to the challenges of that whole dynamic, Troy?
It is. Now, many, many years ago, apparently Hopkinsville had a city manager set up and they changed. I don't quite know the history of why. Now we have a city council of 12, a mayor, and that strong mayor type, and a city administrator. We are definitely, this team and myself, we put a lot of effort in training council members because they're so new. When you come in to city government, county government, even state government, particularly city government, there's a lot you don't know. And we, the CFO and I, I'm on my third mayor in 6 years. The CFO and I always sit down with the mayor, and I have a little spiel that I start out with each one. And we go, we answer to a lot of people. And we do. I live next to a military base, Fort Campbell. We also have the TVA, the Tennessee Valley Authority, which provides pretty much 100% of our electricity here. And, you know, we answer to them, and we answer to a lot of state entities, federal, like everyone else. So we explain that to mayors when they come in. We answer to a lot of people. We explain how funding works. We train council members. We do a private training of new, brand new council members just on budget and finance. Then we have an annual retreat with council members. We choose offsite. It's on a Saturday. And the topics generally go vary, but lately we've just been making them strictly finance, economic development, budgets, because there's a lot of training to help them understand.
Absolutely.
It helps the community. It helps us the more they understand budgeting. So,
And let's be clear, these are part-time council member positions. I mean, the city's got 30,000 population, but you don't have 12 full-time council members getting a salary. They have their regular lives and families and jobs they got to tend to themselves, and they got to get educated and trained up on the complicated matters like, you know, government finance. That's not easy.
And it's a lot of work. And so training them on the budget, then they're up for re-election. And some will come in and go, this isn't for me, jump out. And some, you know, up for re-election and things change over. We had, when I started almost 6 years ago, a 6-6 split of Democrats, Republican. Now it's all Republican. I don't expect much radical change in that in the next election, but you don't know. But I expect a lot of change and turnover in people. So we'll start that process over again.
So have you guys had any discussions internally about changing or modifying? I don't know if you're a charter at all city or how it works over there for your community, but have you guys had discussions about changing the structure? Because I don't think a two-year term structure where everyone's going up at the same time is beneficial or helpful for the community, the elected officials, or the city administrator or manager. Have you guys had any discussions about that?
Not since I've been here, they have not. That is something I speak with our chairman quite frequently, spoke with him this morning, and I'll pick his brain on that. I'd be interested in where he stood on that.
Yeah, I think it'd be much better for everybody if there was a staggered four-year terms at a minimum. I just, that's a tough to have 12 people. I mean, I do not envy you in that. But, you know, Troy, I was actually going to wait for a little bit later in the conversation to talk about race, but you brought up the demographics of the council and the party affiliation and whatnot. So I want to tackle that in a second, and then we'll come back later on. So I want to hit on some of your accomplishments as you in your role as the city administrator here. But, you know, what was interesting about this whole situation is when you and we first met, like I said, over a year ago, and it wasn't literally until a few months ago, I forget exactly what the conversation was or what instigated this exchange that you and I had, but you informed me that you are the only Black manager in Kentucky. Is that still true?
Yes. And you were surprised.
I was dumbfounded by that.
Why?
Yeah, I was dumbfounded by that.
And you at the time were in Kansas, I recall.
Yes.
And I thought, well, how many Black city managers could they have in Kansas?
Huh? Well, we didn't have a lot in Kansas either. I think we had one or two, I think. And we might be down to none now. But I thought Kentucky just had a larger Black population, more Black communities, and I just figured it would be more Black managers there. I've never been in Kentucky. I've maybe driven through it a couple times in my life, but I've never stayed anywhere. And, you know, doing research for this podcast, I find out that Hopkinsville is in Christian County, which is the birth home for Jefferson Davis, who was the president of the Confederate States of America. And then, you know, there's obviously some history there with the Civil War in your neck of the woods that you're in.
You know, how are you going to not mention Abraham Lincoln? Born
I don't know.
In Kentucky.
Oh, well, Abraham Lincoln is a different story altogether. But
Jefferson Davis and Abraham Lincoln born in Kentucky. And Jefferson Davis went to Transylvania University over in Lexington. Now, Lincoln's wife was born in Lexington, and you can see her houses are still standing over there. So it's an interesting history. As far as the race, now this particular town that I'm living in is 34% Black, which is the highest percentage in Kentucky, and probably the most diverse community, racially speaking, in Kentucky. Most people would naturally think, well, that would be Louisville or Lexington.
Right.
In size, Louisville, I believe, is about 18% Black, and it's a city 7. One day, we're all going to have a serious discussion about how we come up with these census numbers. It's a series city of about 700,000 or so, about 18% Black. But pound for pound, Hopkinsville is more diverse than any other place in Kentucky.
And when I was looking on the website, you have a predominantly white council, and now you said that it's all Republican or almost all Republican.
It is all Republican.
Yeah. Was the council, what was the racial split on the council or makeup of the council when you got hired?
I would say about 6-6, as I recall, and 6 Black, 6 white, no other race to my knowledge. That gets tricky.
Right.
The mayor that hired me was a white Republican. Then he left to go take over the Economic Development Commission, which for us, it covers 3 counties here. So he's still here in Hopkinsville, and we work with him every day. But he covers a couple other areas as well. Then Mayor Wendell Lynch, who came on, he was on city council. They appointed him for a short term, and then he ran for election to fulfill the rest of the term of the previous mayor. He was the first elected Black mayor. They had a Black mayor many years ago who was temporarily appointed, but Wendell was the first elected. He was a former bank president and served on myriad boards and so forth, and 8 years on city council. So he sort of just slid in there, and it was a fish to water. It, you know, he would tell us and tell council and tell the public he was learning every day. But he was able probably to hit the ground running more so than most because of his experience with council and sitting on all the various boards for the city and throughout the community. We have a new mayor, J.R. Knight. He won So he's been here a year now, a year and 2 months. So he's the newest one. I am on my third mayor in 6 years, almost 6 years.
So Troy, you have a situation here where you have this non-traditional background, right, to get into city management. And then you get hired into this community, your first ever gig as a city administrator, city manager, with a racially split governing body, predominantly Republican, what have you. Not what you would maybe think of in your mind as being the first or only, not the first, but the only Black city manager in Kentucky, right? If I was thinking about it more of making some stereotypes or stereotypical assumptions, not knowing much about the state, I would say, oh, this guy is a city manager in a town that's predominantly Black with a predominantly Black governing body, and he got hired and he's the only Black member, yada, 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 right? But that's not the case. What kind of challenges and dynamics have you experienced being, or what has it been like to be the only Black manager in the state of Kentucky? Does it mean anything at all? I don't know. I mean, what's the significance of that to you?
In some cases, you're going to have, and I can't speak for Black city managers across the U.S., where their race may be a factor. And mine, and maybe it's my certitude, if that's a word I can use, it hasn't been. And unless someone out there proves me wrong, when Governor Fletcher made me his press secretary, I don't know of another Black press secretary in the history of Kentucky. And in West Virginia, when they made me commissioner of culture and history, there was never another Black press commissioner for that position. So it's not my first rodeo in that area. Yeah. So it really comes down to your certitude. I put my resume and my work experience. We just had a city managers conference in Lexington, Kentucky. It was our winter conference, and obviously I'm the only Black person in the room. But I think very highly of my colleagues. I respect every one of them, but I put my resume and experience up with theirs. I don't feel inferior. There are some of them that have certain skills that I go, I just wish my brain worked that way. I'll speak of Jeff. I'm going to pick on Jeff over in Bowling Green. He has a fascination with numbers. And his number two, Katie, she loves budgeting. You know, I look at numbers and I have to sometimes reread them and study them. But, you know, they all have different skill sets. But in terms of feeling confident in my ability, I feel quite confident. Has my race been a problem? When I was traveling with the governor, and we talked about these things because he was a very cool governor, there were certain counties that I would go in certain areas, not per se Western Kentucky, more where I was actually born in Eastern Kentucky and certain more central areas, where I'm sure if I hadn't been with the governor and a bevy of state police officers, maybe my experience, you know, how I'm welcome and received would have been different. Yeah. I make no excuses about that in Kentucky. I wish I could sit here and pretend we don't have that, but every state in America has it. But for me, I've definitely had some experiences, probably more so in West Virginia than I have in Kentucky, where the governor's office there, for example, Joe, gave me a numbered license plate. And of course, governor had number one, but state police in West Virginia wouldn't let him use it for security reasons. And then you'd see people at 2-3 and all that. They gave me one, and it wasn't exactly the sexiest. When they called me over and said, you want a numbered plate? I think I was 365 or something. Because my friends would always, oh man, you're like the 365th most important person in the state. If this whole 300 people get wiped out, we'll call you. And I took it, put it on because they gave it to me, but I was over in the panhandle closer to DC and all that and got pulled over by some officers once. What are you doing with that plate? And made them call. They had to call the DMV and verify. And it's like, why would you pull me over for something like that? It ain't like I'm riding around with number two or number one on.
Right.
So, yeah, I can't not pretend that I haven't been pulled over and gone through that. But more so in West Virginia than I've ever had in Kentucky.
So Troy, you know, race is obviously a tricky subject. I just released an episode a couple of days ago with Kevin Richardson. I'm not sure when this episode is going to release. I might release it next week. I'm not sure. And I don't think you've had a chance to even listen to it yet. But we had to talk about race a little bit in the public sector, with Black managers and so forth and so on. It's a very difficult conversation to have for obvious reasons. And one of the things we talked about in that interview with Kevin is that him and I are coming from a place where we have mutual respect for each other, appreciation. We have the best, we give each other the benefit of the doubt, right? So we can have a conversation without thinking the worst of somebody. I think a lot of times in our society right now, we're having conversations or we're assuming the worst of other people when they speak. And you and I have a very good history as far as interaction. I got to ask you, what do you think needs to be done, if anything? I guess I don't even want to bias the question, but what do you think needs to be done to help promote or grow the ranks of Black and other minority city managers in this country?
That's a very good question. And in terms of, I guess for me, it was a matter of, I always had a fascination with cities. And I came from a very, very small town. My town is probably more notorious where I was born and raised and popular. Many of your listeners, if you've ever watched the television show Justified, that's based in Harlan County, Kentucky. That's a real town. That's where I was born and raised and where I went to high school and everything else. And it's a very Appalachian mountain town. There's a lot of folk songs about us and so forth, country music songs about you'll never get out of Harlan County alive and so forth. For me, growing up in mountains, I always had a fascination with cities. My mother would drop me off in Detroit when my family is, or in Charlotte and so forth. So for me, it was just, I was going to travel this world, learn about cities and be involved in cities and work in cities. And I was going to make it happen. I knew there were certain things I wanted to do, and I was going to make them happen. In terms of promoting the ranks, I really, honestly, for Black kids, and I'll be very honest, it's like when I was Commissioner of Culture and History, in terms of arts, the team and I, we had various opinions on that. I'm thinking of a young lady that's right now in my head where she really wanted to push classical music in the, deeper in the Appalachian Mountains of West Virginia. And my argument to her was, music is a beautiful, amazing thing, but I want you to love the music you love, what comes naturally to you. What I wanted to push was access to symphonies and orchestras and museum access. But if you go, Joe, and you sit there and you're listening to a symphony and you go, you know what, this is lovely, but this ain't for me.
Right.
Then that's it. I want you to have that exposure, and I'll leave it at that. For young Black kids, if this, you know, having that exposure and hopefully seeing you can have a great impact, you can have a fascinating career, you can be involved in how people live their lives, which is what I think we do in this job. We're quality of life officers. And if you want that, I want to help you in every way I can, open every door possible. But if it ain't for you, it ain't for you. And that's truly how I feel about it. I want people to go into the careers where you're just truly happy. I have a very close friend, and he is really pushing his boys in the direction he wants them to go. And we argue like they're my boys. I'm going, you know, man, I've seen way too many people have way too many problems in life. You know, maybe one drink too many after work or this or that, because they're not following that passion of theirs. And
yeah,
but seriously, internships and apprenticeships of just, this is what we do. This is the impact we can have. If this is of interest to you, let's try to make something happen for you. I really, honestly, that's how I feel. Go, life is very short. Go do the thing that truly brings you joy, not pleasure, but really brings you joy.
Your answer mirrors or parallels Kevin's in a lot of ways. And obviously, it's more of a longer term solution, right? The idea of getting the pipeline sort of primed with the individuals by exposing them to the profession. A lot of people just don't know what's out there, right? If you don't know what's out there, you're never going to have that awareness.
Because
so if you
may
expose
be
it
one
to
of
them,
those kids in a community that doesn't have a city administrator or city manager at
that's
all.
That's right. That's right. You know, one of the things I wanted to touch on with you for a moment is, and that's a little thorny, but you know, I'm a conservative guy, or I lean conservative on the political spectrum, whatever you want to, I'm center right, or right of center, however you want to put me in there. And, you know, I have a natural sort of distaste or frustration with a lot of the DEI stuff I see out there in the current dynamic, right? I'm not against diversity. I'm not against opportunities and so forth and so on. I am against this idea that you promote people or reward people just based on the color of your skin or things of that sort of nature. And there's elements of the DEI and our current environment that I want to support and I want to obviously oppose. And I guess for me, one of the things that I kind of bothers me is this idea that, well, just because someone is this race or this demographic, we need to somehow raise them up and give them something, right? As opposed to letting them earn it or whatnot. And I think for me, and I was talking this about Kevin, and I think, like, you know, that's why I feel comfortable having this conversation with you. You know, I didn't want to have you on the show just a virtue signal, like, oh, I know a black manager, let's have him on the show, right? I mean, I thought you're going to be on the show a lot longer, to be honest, but you're playing hard to get, you know? So I had to wait several months, Troy, to get you over here. I thought you were going to be in the first 10 episodes, but...
You called my agent. You
know? But, you know, I think what we need to do more in the profession is not spotlight or put a shine on a manager because they're a woman or because they're black or because they're Hispanic. I think we need to put shine and spotlights on managers who happen to be black or happen to be females because they are really good at what they do. You know what I mean?
I do.
And that's where I think things are getting kind of lost in the translation. I want to see us shine lights on those managers who are just kicking ass and taking names. And oh, by the way, they happen to be black or they happen to be female or whatnot, you know? And this kind of brings us back to how we're having this conversation, you know, because I look at you and your background, your resume, and I'm like, man, this guy should be, everyone should be calling this guy. They should be recruiting you left and right. You know what I mean? You should have an agent. You know what I mean? And so, you know, you have a lot of great track record of success and where you've gone. And that's where I feel like,
as you know, that you have to deliver. Listen,
yes.
You can't fake it. This is in international affairs. I've seen reports that go home, when I say home, to the United States from various folks, and you go, that's just fluff. That's just airy puffs of legislative cotton candy. There's no substance to it. But here, you know, if we don't pick your trash up on Wednesday.
That's damn right.
You know, if we haven't brined and salted that road on an icy morning, and we got to stay on top of the weather too. You know, if that grass isn't cut, you know, if those events at the park or how the park is, you know, if people are running your street. We had one homicide in this town last year, and we've got a new police chief, and I mean, I'm having lunch with him tomorrow. That guy takes no prisoners, tease him a lot, but he scares me a little, and he is tough, and we have to deliver. And that's the beauty of this type of work. And I don't mean that offensive to my colleagues in state, or federal, or international. We deliver. And if not, we hear about it. We answer to the public on a daily basis. We live here. They live
absolutely
here. Not just on email and on phone calls at church, in the supermarket, in the movie theater, and at council meetings. I mean, they are designed and structured around the public, and there's public comment on that agenda, which is structure is set by law, so they can come and address us. So we must deliver, we must work, and you won't survive in this position. And I'm going to go one step further. You shouldn't survive in this position if you cannot deliver.
That's right.
It's like swimming. You throw somebody in the ocean, damn it, they better swim.
That's right. Let's talk about, I know we got a little bit of a time crunch because you got a busy day, Troy, and I want to get through some of your accomplishments on your track record, because obviously if I'm just going to have to talk about, put a spotlight on a manager because they're successful at getting the job done.
You should have me and Kevin and some of us back together if you want.
I'd love that. I would love to do that.
My fee isn't that expensive.
So let's talk about some of your accomplishments, okay? I was really intrigued by the fact that you have this international background, obviously, and you have had tremendous exposure at various levels of government, interacting with different agencies, people of all different walks of life, right? And you have this base that's near you that is – it's near you, but it's not adjacent. I think it's like 30 minutes away, correct? Maybe I got the geography wrong. Yeah. Right. And yet you have this agreement with them where you're also providing services to that organization. That's got to be a challenging – road to maneuver, I guess. Can you walk us through that dynamic and also what impact being that close to a base actually has on your organization?
It's, first of all, Fort Campbell is tremendous, and we love it. I believe it's the fourth largest in the country. The agreement you're talking about is called an IGSA, I-G-S-A, an intergovernmental service agreement, where we provide certain services to the military that they could provide for themselves, but we can do it cheaper, quite frankly. And they had a meeting several years ago to introduce us. The garrison commander, who's sort of like the city manager of the base or the installation, had us from Clarksville, Tennessee, and all the surrounding cities. We have a host of services. Would you guys bid on them and be interested on them? For our city, we looked over all those services he was offering up for a year, because quite frankly, there are some contracts you can get off the base and you can provide a service to the military, and you can make money and things for your community. It's win-win. There are others that you go, this won't work. Like the grass cutting, for example. Fort Campbell's like a city. You know, it's about 60,000 people on there. And military contracts are just complicated. There were certain things they didn't want us to leave the equipment on the installation. I said, you want me to put these things on the interstate every single day? They wanted us to rake it. And I'm not kidding. I said, well, now look, there are machines that cut this up and put it back in the soil or back. No, we want it raked. But that's not going to work. So I did call cities that are parallel to military installations around the country and had ICSA contracts. And for example, Fort Polk down in Louisiana, they were very informative, telling me some of these contracts are great. Some won't work for your cities. Don't just jump at everything. Say no if it's not good for you, because you'll get trapped in some areas that you just don't want to. We chose the ones that would work for us. We've been delivering for them for a few years, and we hope to meet with them. Actually, I got a call with them next week, and then start exploring even more opportunities to provide for the military. It's a sense of pride having guys on the installation, you know, providing that service. And also it's a benefit. They buy heavy equipment for us. They provide people for us. And when we're not at use down there using that equipment, we have every right, as they tell us, to use it within our community.
Awesome.
And you can make some profit off of it, which we do. And we don't do it for that. But there's certain things like buying road salt. We order it every year, and we order it for them. We don't touch it. They literally deliver it to them, but we get it at a rate far cheaper than what they were getting it for. So we're just saving them tons of money. And this goes on all around the country, and I believe overseas too. So it's awesome. A pride for us to be
awesome.
Able to
work with them. Talk to, you know, a couple of weeks ago, I put an episode out. It was really popular about the state of fire EMS service in America with Tim Nowak. And it was really popular, got a lot of attention. He's talking about the impending crisis in fire and EMS across the country, especially in some of the smaller rural departments. You have on your resume dividing up or separating your fire EMS department.
We had to.
Yeah. Walk us through that.
I didn't interrupt you.
No, walk us through that. Yeah.
When I first got here, fire, the city ran the EMS. Now, those of you out there who don't know, there's a CON, a certificate of need, which comes from the state that dictates who runs the service in your county. The county here, Christian County, has the CON, but we actually run the service for the whole county. And our fire department was doing that, but they were using firefighters. And we had a big gap of trying to retain firefighters. We live near Nashville, which is a blessing, but our local hospital was always having runs to Nashville. So I guarantee, as I sit here with you, I probably got two ambulances in Nashville right now, but we're also a couple hours from Louisville. I probably got one up there that way. They were always on the road. This isn't just a community run to the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
We're on the interstate. And, you know, we kept having that conversation with the chief that was here when I first got here. And I talked to him, we got to separate these things, and it would help us understand the financing better and get these EMTs that want to do this as opposed to firefighters who don't really want to do it, and they kept leaving us. He would say yes, and then he'd send back the next day say no. He took another job over in Clarksville, Tennessee, and when the new chief came on, we were like, we got to do this, and he was gung-ho. He separated it. And there were many benefits to that. A, you got these EMTs in that this is what they want to do. They're never going to complain about being in an ambulance. They know what they signed up for. Mm-hmm. It helped us in other ways. It helped us in terms of, you spoke earlier about diversity and women, because I think at that time we had only one female firefighter. And so
That's a great point, because they make the requirement to be a firefighter is different than to be an EMT,
absolutely,
right?
And yeah. What also it helped us is looking at the finances, because the ambulance service here is ran by an ambulance board. It's not taxpayer dollars, but it was taxpayer dollars because it was so linked to the fire department. They were using so much of our services, electricity, our buildings, everything, staff. By separating us, we were able to delineate what is the responsibility of the ambulance board, of which I'm a member, and what belongs to the city, and charge appropriately. So it really was a big savings to the taxpayers as well in terms of being more fiduciary responsible. We are fully staffed. We have one of the busiest ambulance services in Kentucky. And I say that, no exaggeration, we are the third busiest, about 15,000 runs a year. You have Louisville, Lexington, and us. And put that in perspective, there are cities bigger than us. Say, go back to Bowling Green, which is 80,000, and we're 30,000, but we're outrunning them left and right.
Yeah.
It's a busy team. But we are geographically located where doctors will send you to Nashville for specialties and so forth. So we're always on the road. If you sign up with us, we'll take care of you. with the best service in Kentucky, but you will be busy. We'll make no apologies for it. If you sign up with us, you're going to work.
What do you consider your favorite or most, what accomplishment are you most proud of in your time with Hopkinsville?
Oh, God. Each mayor that has come in had a different priority. There was a WINS initiative when I came in, and I'm sorry, I'm forgetting that acronym, WINS, but we built bridges and built parks and redid sidewalks and roads. It was about connectivity and physical fitness and bringing the community, real community development that Carter Hendricks wanted to do. We built a sportsplex. We did all that and got it done and got it accomplished, and I was very proud of that. The next mayor that came in, Wendell Lynch, he was a banker, and he focused on closing all those loopholes and making sure the public got every dollar that they spent, they got their money's worth, and making sure if you owed us money, you paid us, helping me get the software to make things easier to take in the revenue. And now I have a new mayor, J.R. Knight, we've created an initiative called Growing Home. It's about cleaning up the city. We have tons of vacant lots. It's about getting that community pride back and also growing home in various aspects. We created, to our knowledge, the only small business commission in Kentucky. I brought several programs from New Orleans, like the lot next door, to help us get rid of these 1,000 vacant lots. I've seen the revenue grow, and our reserves is more than doubled since I've been here. I think financially, we are watching every penny, and we're more secure financially, so we don't have to sit around and talk about raising taxes. We are quite capable at this time with living with the money that the public give us and delivering the highest possible service. This is a very hardworking team, and they make do with what they got. But we do, for that council, I have to tell you, I've got this council now that they have given us pretty much everything we asked for. And there's a lot of that, and I'm very candid with them. I wouldn't want to sit around and have a retreat and have the meetings and discuss some of the things I bring them, because it's not sexy. You don't cut a ribbon to it. But if you got a, I mean, honestly.
That's right.
And I said this to them. If you got a golf course, I wouldn't want to sit here on a Saturday and talk about grass seeds. But nobody has, and we have to do it. We've got these lakes, and we've got to take care of them. There's a lot of the unsexy things. I don't want public works officials coming in an hour early fixing lawnmowers, because there are consequences, residual consequences of, okay, let's open a new park and cut a ribbon on it. Well, that means more police officers, more public works, more cutting of grass, more, yep. You know, let's put all kinds of new cameras on it. Well, we got to budget differently. Those cameras and that software come with expenses. So, Joe, to your listeners, when you buy a car, you pay it cash, you're not done.
No.
There's always an oil change and gas and alignments and all that.
And so you sure as hell better be refilling up those coffers if you want to buy another car when that car goes dead, right? I mean, it's just in there. Yeah.
So how we budget it, how we structure the staff, how we deliver those services. I know people don't want to get philosophical about what we do because they say, well, go back to the beginning of this interview. You pick up trash, you cut grass. We do that, but we do more than that. It is important to ask, I think, three questions if you do what we do. What type of people do you want your residents to be? And what type of community do they wish to live? And most importantly, and if you really can't answer this, you shouldn't be doing what we do, is how do they want to live their lives? And that's why I say we're quality of life officers, because we have to answer that question. We have to know it. You can't guess. And then you have to deliver. Well, this isn't the job for you.
Troy, I know you have limited time. We're going to wrap it up here. I want to tell you, you know, I really think we need to take you on a roadshow or put you in a webinar, because I really feel like one of your greatest accomplishments has just been your ability to navigate your large governing body, the diverse governing body that you have, the turnover that you have, the every 2 years, the education, the ramping up. I just think that's an amazing skill that you've acquired. And I think that's something that a lot of city managers who do not have to go through that continual turnover, right? But they're on the staggered 4-year terms. We could all probably use some of your wisdom in that area. So
you wouldn't be maybe able to do it without the team that I have. I'm not blowing smoke. I put this team up against any team you got in the country.
Anybody you want to spotlight and give them a shout out while we got the show going?
Honestly, like I talked about the ambulance service in a smaller town, and we put ourselves up against Lexington, Louisville any day of the week and delivering like there's nobody business. The Parks and Rec team wins. It's almost every year we're winning the state awards, but the only reason we can't collect them every year, now they have to, you can only win every other year. And we do. And that's just awesome. This whole team, the police department of, you know, I've had one homicide last year, and that was, you know, there is really nothing you can do about that because the presence of the police department and how our police department works in what you call the inner cities with the Black community. And I don't use that word. And I know some mayors out there in bigger cities use community policing. I always scratch my head with that because I thought, well, all policing is community policing. What else is it?
Right.
I don't even understand that term. I've tried to study it and it makes no sense to me. I think our guys on the ground truly doing it. They live here. This is their town. They take pride in it and they're making it the best they can be. This is the best team. I tell them they rock. And our little staff newsletter that I send them, I couldn't be more proud to serve this team.
That's amazing. That's awesome. Hey, Troy, thank you very much for being on the program. I've enjoyed having you on. And I thank you for your friendship and just, you know, the kindness you've shown me over the last year and a half and the support. You've been one of the original founding members of the International Brotherhood of City Managers.
Someday.
So thank you so much. I am Joe Turner. This is the City Manager Unfiltered Podcast, a podcast for city managers and other public sector executives. If you really enjoy this content, please hit the like and subscribe button or leave a rating and review on your platform of choice, especially if you're an Apple user trying to get to those 200 reviews. So thank you very much and catch you next time.